Welcome, welcome, welcome to Nodes in the Net, a weekly tangential, irreverent conversation that caters to the interests of liminal trickster mystics like you. And like Colin Reinagal, also known as CJ on the Creek Mason Discord server. You may have noticed him pop in somewhat recently via the Duncan Trussell Family Hour to Creek Mason pipeline, I guess you could call it. CJ, I mean, instantly when he joined the server, I knew this was going to be someone who I'd want to have on the podcast. And it was exactly everything that I hoped the conversation would be. It was wide ranging. It was tangential. It was deep and it was heartfelt. This was a really great conversation with CJ or Colin, however you want to know him. Colin is a artist. He creates like studio art out of a mixture of mediums, and some of his stuff is available online, which you should definitely check out. I just heard the good news that he got spotted by a dealer. An art dealer, not a you know, drug dealer. Although, what's the difference between art and drugs, right? but he's moving these pieces and getting that public validation from the universe means a lot, I know. And why not be that public validation? His stuff is fucking beautiful and really emotionally evocative. It's like powerful to behold. So check that out. You're going to be able to find it at creekmasons.substack.com along with all of the other links to his socials and things that you might be interested in as a result of listening to him on this episode. So yes, head to creekmasons.substack.com. Won't you please subscribe to our newsletter where you're going to get blog updates from me and various other things. It is a great place to stay connected to the Creek Masons, and there are ways littered throughout the Creek Mason Substack to become an initiated member and join us on the Discord, where there are then secret further levels of initiation that you may or may not discover. But we'd love to have you. We'd love to chat with you and connect to more and more liminal trickster mystics who bring the energy to our community, like Colin and potentially like you. So I'm going to read a little bit from the poem that I wrote for this week's Lunar Lunacy prompt. Or I guess I should say last month's Lunar Lunacy prompt. I'm kind of a month behind in posting them. Lunar Lunacy is the group creative project of the Creek Mason Creative Coven, you might say. Although, you know, whether you vibe with the word coven or not is totally optional. But the idea is we all kind of come together and create art and poetry based on a prompt that we all decide together. And it's a little stale right now, so I'd love to inject some of your energy into it. But here's my poem for last month's moon. It's called Belonging versus Alienation. Trudging the sidewalk, melancholy, downtrodden, dejectedly watching the cracks pass. When I lift my gaze, the sky fades away, the clouds appearing to retreat. My eyes are habituated to compensating for what the world looks like to someone lacking the confidence to hold his head high. So yeah, join us for Lunar Lunacy, and I'm gonna pop into the server right now and get our next prompt going. So there's plenty of time to join if you want to create a poem. I bet you could write something a lot better than what I'm able to write. Poetry is probably not really my strong suit. But first, why don't you listen to this wonderful episode of Nodes in the Net with the great Colin Reinagal. Enjoy. Colin.
Hey, Jeff. It's great to be here.
Hey, yeah. Thank you so much for joining me on a Friday, no less.
My pleasure. I'm thankfully in a space right now where I don't have too many responsibilities. So Friday afternoon is perfect for me.
Wonderful. Yeah. Who wants responsibilities? Like
some people.
So Colin, also known as CJ on the server, you are the webmaster of Weird Life Studios. What do you call yourself? Are you comfortable owning the title artist?
I believe so. Yeah, I've been doing it for about 5 years now. Let's see. I've been writing music my whole life. That's where that all kind of started. COVID happened. It was impossible to get instrumentalists together. I wasn't going to school anymore. So I needed to pivot and found embroidery as really, really a love of mine.
Yeah. And it's like, I mean, it's not, you know, like bedazzling jeans that you're doing. Necessarily, you know what I mean? I don't even think that's embroidery either, but like the stuff that you make is really like beautiful. It's emotional, it's evocative. It's
thank you so much. It's really, you know, it's really confirming to hear that. Obviously, anybody who picks up a paintbrush or a needle, in my case both, is always going to have that question in the back of my mind of, am I really an artist? Or am I a hobbyist? Or am I a craftsperson? You know, there's always that doubt. So it's so confirming to hear from somebody who's never really met me.
Yeah.
To say that.
I know, right? It's like my mom will tell me I'm an artist, but I,
exactly.
She's got like maybe a bit of a bias.
Yep. It's so special. It goes right up on the fridge. We see it every day, right?
Yeah. You know, this is, it's actually perfect. We were talking about like the many varied directions that our episode could take, and we decided to roll the dice on it and let Poimandris decide for us. And it's always a little bit, like you said, affirming to see that we're already on the right track. We've drawn the Eight of Swords, which is, you know, it's the woman who's sort of like loosely tied up and blindfolded on like sort of swampy ground with eight swords kind of surrounding her, but not really surrounding her. Like the thing about this card that everybody always likes to point out is that the swords don't form like a complete prison. It's not a circle totally entrapping her. If she like wriggled her way out of her bandages, you know, which don't seem like they're tying her very, very securely, she could rip off this blindfold and realize that she could, you know, walk out of this ring of swords, no problem.
It's a
card of like negative self-talk and self-limiting beliefs. It's a card of kind of like overcoming low self-esteem or feelings of being like trapped into a role that you don't necessarily align with. And I feel like that's just exactly what we were talking about.
Yeah, certainly. As far as, you know, I've been doing this, I've been pursuing this as an artist, I've appeared in museums, but there is still that self-doubt and that second guessing. It's really curious because as you were describing it, I've seen the card several times myself, but it was the first time I realized if she doesn't take off the blindfold and it's like her arms are restrained as well, correct?
Right, yes.
And if she doesn't take those off, she's not a prisoner, but she's probably going to trip and fall and cut herself on one of the swords.
Hmm, I like that take. What does that bring up?
This idea of, well, taking time, first of all, to orient yourself and making sure that you're seeing the world clearly. And that could be anything from healing your trauma to, you know, communicating better in your relationship to not turning on red so often, you know, whatever that means to you before kind of trying to take an unsteady step in possibly a new or dangerous direction.
Yeah, that's right. She could very easily take a step in the wrong direction and end up injured if she were to act with too much haste. I like that. So, there's something kind of the through line among all of those things you just listed is that, that like clarity, I guess. It's seeing things the way they really are and communicating them also, in an accurate way. So what can we do? How can we bring that into our lives?
See, I usually will talk about the things that I am needing, not necessarily the things that I am good at.
Yeah.
I've heard from some people that, you know, authenticity, as far as when you look at the frequency of emotions and whatnot, that authenticity is thousands of times a higher frequency than even love or gratitude, where your thoughts and your words and your actions are in complete alignment with your truest beliefs. But this same individual described to me the process of how when we are traumatized or when we are, you know, conditioned or judged or internalized something that we shouldn't, that our psyche will begin the process of fracturing itself off into component parts.
Yes.
Because your brain says, I don't like this. I want to hide this, but there's nothing else in here but me. So what can I hide it behind? Another piece of myself.
Yeah. So this is, first of all, wonderful that this is coming up, because I've been reading like a ton of Ram Dass, well, listening to the, you know, the Here and Now lectures. But like, also I'm reading this book right now called The Awakened Family. That's like, it's by Shefali Sarberry, and her whole perspective on parenting is, and I'm like, I'm preparing for a kid to arrive sometime in the next couple months. And so,
congratulations.
Thank you. Her perspective on parenting is that it can be used as a kind of yoga to bring you and the child into greater spiritual alignment. Basically, like alignment with the God that you already are. So this, like, this idea of being like authentic to your true self. I mean, I don't know. What do you think? What is that true self? You know, because there's a difficulty for me in like believing that there is a me sometimes, you know, but some of these practices seem to suggest that, like, in a way I am like an aspect of everything, and as an aspect I'm a self-contained individual. It's kind of tricky to wrap your mind around.
It really is. And there are so many different opinions that people have had about this idea all the time. You know, every generation is going to come up with some new philosophy to describe the self and how that fits in. But the common thread, and I want to jump back to another phrase that you used after that, before this, but the common thread through all of that is that we are aware of the fact that individuality is not so cut and dry. Nobody sits there and ponders the universe and says, yup, I'm just me. Nothing else is connected. It's all its own thing, and I'm just me. Nobody says that.
Yeah, no one I know, at least.
Yeah. But so I think there is this, you know, you said the phrase, the God that I already am, or something to that. Please correct me if I'm not rephrasing that correctly.
It may not have been my exact words, but I'll own it anyway. I like it.
Yeah, this idea that we are From a Christian perspective, for instance, a child of God, what does that make us? Baby gods, you know? Or if you believe that the whole universe is just divinity expressing itself, we are then an expression of divinity. What else? Let's see. If God is, and this is, I was raised in a very Christian environment. I don't necessarily identify with Christianity anymore, but I think the core philosophies of Abrahamic monotheism, you know, which then lends itself to Judaism, to Islam, to, you know, a lot of these fundamental religions around the world, is this attempt to understand a universal God, you know, this thing that is beyond all, above all, throughout all, before and after everything. We want to explain that, because if God is everywhere, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, you can't draw a circle around any part of the universe and say, that's God, everything else isn't. You can't even say there's a higher concentration of God particles in this within this circle.
Yeah.
And so we are all to that effect. The whole universe is to that effect, part and parcel, infinitely God. You can't divide infinity. So for me, it's this kind of, I've heard it, a friend described it to me as pantheism. All is divine. All is God. God is all. You can't have the universe and God as separate things.
Yeah. I vibe with that very much. A series of books that I keep returning to is like the channeled works of Paul Selig. And, you know, he's got these beings without bodies, these guides who apparently speak through him. And that's one of the things that they're always saying is like, it's impossible to put anything in the universe outside of God. I love the way that there's no place that you can like draw a circle that the concentration of God particles is higher. But like, but what does that say about this shadow characteristic that you were bringing up initially? Like, is, or maybe that's the wrong way to phrase it, but this, you know, hiding of my authentic self behind another part of my like ego self, there's, in the hiding, I'm in some way obscuring the like maximal expression of God, right? And so how can I do that if even the thing that is being hidden behind is also God, you know? It's almost hard to talk about because you have to use like the same five words.
Exactly. It's like some kind of reverse quantum physics. But I mean, I have seen it. This is how I've heard it expressed. And this is from another very, esoteric is the wrong word, but it's the right vibe source of a man who claimed in the late 60s to have telepathic contact with space people from Venus. And they were able to describe God, quote unquote, the ruling body of the universe, because they are supposedly a step closer to it than we are here on Earth. This idea that we would begin, per se, on Pluto and go to heaven from Pluto, which would be Neptune, and so on and so forth into the sun, to the center of the galaxy, to the center of the universe. Okay. As our souls progress and die and reincarnate enough times that they find nirvana, and then you find nirvana again, and then you find, you know, and this idea that we're kind of a sonar wave after a fashion. We are supposed to collect information and return to source with that information about the state of being. we're kind of, in that capacity, we're kind of God's, not God's immune system, but maybe the alarm systems.
Mm.
Not to imply that God can get sick or be sick or anything like that, but that this, we act as this kind of observing force, this sort of mirror through which God can perceive itself or themselves.
Okay. Yeah, I dig that. I dig that. It's a way. Well, it's interesting that you use the immune system metaphor, and alarm, you know, like, I mean, even the idea that like this maximally expansive concept of God that we're describing could get alarmed, like it kind of suggests something interesting because the way I typically think about alarm is like, there's a loud bang in the house while I'm trying to fall asleep. And the alarm in me is that, like, I don't know what created that sound. But, I mean, do you know what I mean? There's something about the unknown that it...
Yeah, and I think it's hard to jive... it's hard to meld the concepts of everything is God with also free will and unpredictability.
Yeah.
You know, there are chaotic forces sometimes that inflict massive destruction upon the undeserving. You know, you can't say that God is everything without then saying that, okay, God is also cruel. God is also evil. God is also, you know, murderous.
Yeah. Unless you want to do the like Ram Dass thing and say that, like, you know, that like New Agey thing and say, well, those souls incarnated into that part of the earth to experience, you know, like God needed to have that like experience of trauma in order to burn off some kind of karma or have some kind of unique experience of what it's like to be an incarnated being. And it feels like a very hand-wavy way to potentially numb yourself to the suffering of people who need our help, you know?
Definitely. That, I mean, I hear where you're coming from because obviously there's so much of that within the story of Jesus Christ himself, the one person that Christians do believe is God incarnate.
Right.
Who, you know, they always highlight. He was born in kind of gross conditions, poverty, danger to his life in his early years. And then obviously still attaining that level of consciousness that he did to where as he was dying on the cross, he was able to hold the entirety of humanity within his mind as he was dying.
Mm. Yeah, say more about that. I don't, so like I was raised more or less atheist, maybe agnostic, and I've kind of like, I had like a hyper religious spell in college and like took a bunch of classes on world religion and stuff and got really interested in trying to like figure out a way to put together my own cosmology that authentically resonated with whatever my intuitive, you know, beliefs about the universe were. So I know less about like the dominant religion here in the United States, Christianity, than I do about like maybe like Buddhism or yoga or something. So I'd love to hear someone who is steeped in it tell me a little bit more about that.
Certainly, steeped is one word for that. But this concept of, you know, Jesus being born of a virgin birth, first of all, there's some issues with that, but, you know, born to Mary and Joseph in a barn, you know, experiencing then the king of the region, King Herod, being threatened by the King of Kings. They have to immediately go into exile to Egypt. His family, you know, his family were immigrants, didn't speak the language, no family, no connections. You know, eventually they're able to move back. He kind of lives a normal life until his 20s or 30s, you know, his early 20s, generally people say. He has a profound experience. He goes into the wilderness and doesn't eat anything for 40 days and comes back telling everybody, hey, God incarnate as man. So there's obviously, we had talked about kind of God wanting to experience this suffering as possibly, I don't know why Katrina comes to mind, but as someone living through Katrina, God needed to add that experience to their book of memories. That is a lot within Christianity, that Jesus came here fully knowing and fully aware that he was then going to be killed by the Roman Empire for causing so much dissent and spreading so many ideas, and flipping that it would be
money tables and things like that.
I'm sorry. Could you say that again? I couldn't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Well, it's because I interrupted you. That's my fault. But the flipping over of the moneylenders' tables in the temple, right? Like that's the Jesus I really identify with. Like,
oh, definitely. Yeah, he was a mess for the powers that be.
Yeah,
and what his immediate disciples would do afterwards is, I think, might even be more resonant to a lot of these people who've probably got maybe even an antagonistic view of Christianity in the modern times, which is that these churches all over Rome then, and you can hear a little bit about them if you read the rest of the New Testament, which is Paul's letter to these churches, to the church in Corinth, the book of Corinthians, you know? And what they would do is... there was no concept of personal property. If you were a member of these churches, everything that you owned, quote unquote, was available to the whole collective. Everyone shared everything. They would prepare meals together. They would live in communal housing at times, you know, and work. They would have plots of land that they would work together. Even people would sell their properties, sell their possessions, and give it all to expanding these communes.
Yeah.
These religious communes.
That's what they sound like, yeah.
Yeah. And so Jesus was this radical revolutionary coming up in an imperialist empire with a very strong market economy, preaching, you know, radical love and acceptance, and whose followers would then go on to create these communes.
Yeah.
And it's so uncanny. I recently learned about Pythagoras. I'm sorry, I'm rambling.
No, you're good. You're good. This is already, I mean, like, this is so interesting. You know, America has this history of, like, communes, especially in the last, like, 50 years or whatever, getting, like, really violently crushed by the imperial, you know, forces of the kind of like control society. And yeah, like a lot of them were abusive or whatever and dangerous in many ways. But it is really interesting to hear these like parallels, and it almost sort of feels like the Romans of the modern era are not going to make the same mistake and let another, you know, thing like that happen.
Well, maybe not. Yeah, because then what happened? Fast forward 500 years, and those churches, those kind of intentional communities built around shared land and shared goods became kingdoms in the Western Roman Empire. And that's where we have, like, the Dark Ages.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so Pythagoras, this is the guy who, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, right?
Yeah, that was his formula for a square triangle. His life is actually so crazy. He's somebody that, like, his father grew up in ancient Greece, obviously. His father heard from the Oracle of Delphi that his son was going to be super important. I'm paraphrasing so much because this is something that I've only surface level been exposed to.
Okay.
But he has, you know, legends about his life as he's living it. Another interesting comparison, he has to leave his hometown and go to a colony in Italy at the time to avoid a tyrannical government. In the same way Jesus had to leave his hometown and flee to Egypt to avoid King Herod. But he believed, Pythagoras, that math was... the mathematical order of the universe was the expression of divine influence. Essentially that if God was sitting there designing the universe, if divinity was creating everything, the first thing it would do is start with numbers. It would start with the math of it all. And so by learning the math behind the universe, you could then know divinity indirectly.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, it reminds me of like, I don't know, like Elon Musk's always talking about how we live in a simulation, like that kind of thing. You can intuit through these like natural mathematical laws the like source code of our reality, like that kind of thing. I don't know. I don't love Elon Musk or anything, but
I don't either. And that's certainly, you know, the simulation theory is kind of a bastardization of this original idea. Okay. You know, because what are we saying? That the universe was intentionally planned and designed by an advanced being or an advanced structure of beings. Well, why are we saying, why should we, you know, use diminishing language about anything then? If, you know, I take that and say, let's be super careful about what kind of video games we make. If that's reality.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this idea that divinity is, you can see divinity through math. The reason I brought him up, because he also founded what was considered a cult at the time. And the definition of the word cult was different. It was a group of people who had access to exclusive knowledge. And you would see a lot of cults pop up around teachers just because you can't post a podcast onto the internet and tell everybody about your ideas.
Yeah. That's so funny. The triangle guy had a cult. Like,
yeah. And then he ran his cult exactly like Jesus's disciples ran the churches in ancient Rome.
So who came first?
Pythagoras.
Okay.
Yeah, Pythagoras was at least a few hundred years BC, but I'm talking out of my ass with that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, no one's fact checking us, but for sure earlier than Jesus and in like ancient Greece, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. So he's got this cult of math worshippers, I guess.
Pretty much. Pretty much, for lack of a better term. Yeah.
Awesome. I'm looking again at the Eight of Swords, and the, like, you know, the blindfold is calling out to me. There is something about seeing the world in terms of mathematical principles that feels, I don't know, maybe more or less obstructed, less abstractified than Hang on one second. My dog is barking. I'll be right back. And we're back.
All right.
Abstractified obviously isn't a word, but there's something about referential language that feels like you're applying like a layer of language on top of the like true workings of, I guess, what to use the words earlier, like the true nature of God, if God is all things and all, you know, whatever, then like trying to describe that using language creates this like step of separation. Whereas if you're describing things in mathematical terms, maybe you can get a little bit closer to the actual God itself.
Yeah, it's funny. This part of the conversation is really making me think of my family. And I gotta say, I love my family. They're each member of my family is brilliant in their own right. And I've gotten a lot of this philosophical background originally from conversations with my father and my grandfather. But my mother has always said that she loved math more. She wouldn't even participate in the conversations, but she loved math because with math, there's always a right answer.
Yeah.
There's that absolute certainty that 1 + 1 = 2 every time.
Right.
And so that does then track with the idea of you would expect God to be consistent in every situation.
It feels intuitively wrong somehow, though. Like, maybe there's too much variation between one situation and another that I feel like I might hesitate to apply the same. Like, certainly not here's what it is. Like, to say that two situations are the same thing is describing them with language, and you're using a descriptor that equates two things, and I guess like you can kind of have that like two right angle triangles, right, are going to be the same, but I feel like when it comes to understanding nature, I don't know, there's not a lot of right angles, still there's math that governs everything, and that like there does,
mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
If you want to look at the Fibonacci spiral, that is a rabbit hole in and of itself that you can get lost in for the rest of your life.
people turn into. What's his name? Jim Carrey's character in 23 when they get too invested in the Fibonacci sequence.
Oh, yes.
You know, happen.
Mm-hmm. So there definitely are these mathematical principles that rule nature, but I think you're right in saying that kind of expecting any kind of blanket statement because would be against the intuition because if everything is God, and if God is math, everything is an equation. No two equations are ever going to be the same. But in order to solve any equation, we need to know that 1 plus 1 equals 2.
Mm.
And I just did the shrug, like, does that seem right?
Yeah, it feels right. Yeah, I mean, we need to have proofs, I guess, right? It's like we need to have things that we like can understand in order to apply them to a wide variety of situations where they're applied in different levels and in different amounts. But like, yeah, ultimately, there needs to be some level of law or sense to things in order for anything to work. But then, I mean, like, but that breaks down at the quantum level, right? Like, I'm certainly not going to pretend I understand quantum physics, but it all comes down to like probability and uncertainty and all that horrible stuff.
Yeah. No, that's one of those rabbit holes where you could just spend the rest of your life and probably several lifetimes trying to understand that nothing really makes sense and everything is kind of a possibility and it only exists when we look at it, but when we look at it, it changes. And I don't.
Yeah.
It is a whole mess. I like to stay at the level of like, you know, Planck's constant. Again, any of these concepts, you know, you could make your entire doctoral dissertation and then some. But
oh yeah,
Planck's constant. If you change even, you know, the tiniest bit, the universe doesn't exist. The universe as we know it is so fundamentally different. If that number is off.
Say more about that. What is Planck's constant?
I don't know fully. I don't understand that one completely. I can honestly Google it right now, but I understand that it has to do with the laws of physics. That it is a universal constant that defines quantum nature. I'm reading this off of Google right now. That defines the quantum nature of energy and relates to the energy of a photon to its frequency. So this is how we are figuring out energy and photons and what all of that means. But if that number is any different, this is just how I was exposed to it more philosophically, that if that number was changed, then energy wouldn't be energy. Energy wouldn't work.
Right.
Energy wouldn't then form matter. Matter wouldn't work. It wouldn't function properly. The equations that are needed for energy to energy would require Planck's constant.
Gotcha. Yeah.
I feel like such a, I don't know. Not a fraud, but the imposter syndrome is very real.
No, it's all good. We're doing bro science here on Nerds in the Net today. That's fine. We can do a little bro science, but let's bring it back to somewhere maybe that you are a little bit more on like firm footing. Because I know, like, one of the things that we've talked about on the server, on the Greek Mason Discord, has been this this figure of Pythagoras. And I think most people know of him just for the Pythagorean theorem. And there's, like, I've maybe, like, a hint of other knowledge as a result of reading Manly P. Hall's Secret Teachings of All Ages. And there's like a chapter on Pythagoras, but I've like honestly forgotten most of it. I would almost count myself among the people who think of him as just the triangle guy, you know?
Yeah. Pythagoras did a lot more besides triangles. I know of him, I guess I was more so exposed to this through music theory, and I can't say enough about how disappointed in myself I am for falling out of music theory study, but also in general for the world of falling out of music theory study. For so many years, it was part of the core philosophy set. You would learn language, you would learn writing, and you would learn an instrument, you know, and you wouldn't consider yourself a full thinker necessarily in some parts of the world in some times. You know, France mostly comes to mind. But because music is this expression of physics and therefore math, and Pythagoras was one of the first people to ever figure this out, he was testing string using weights. He would hang the string from a ceiling, hang one size weight, and then a weight that was exactly double. And that was how he figured out octaves and perfect fifths, by testing these ratios and seeing that do these harmonies, these sounds that sound good together, also express these perfect mathematical ratios of frequency and vibration. He was the first person to kind of figure that out.
Ah.
So the frequency, this is something that comes up a lot in my life because of all the new agey shit I consume. But like frequency, I think what that means is like, if we're talking about a string that's, I don't know, double the length of another string, then if they have the same frequency, they're in this, like, they're maybe octaves apart, or how does that work?
This is so much best explained with visual aids, but yeah. Yeah, if you can think in terms of sine curves and just the perfect waveform mathematically, if you double that speed exactly, if you have one sine wave and a second that is happening twice per,
in the same amount of time that it takes for one to go up and then down and then back to base,
you have one that does it exactly twice. Those two are going to be an octave apart.
Okay.
If the ratio is 4 to 5, you have a perfect fifth. You know, and that's where we get those musical harmonies and disharmonies, essentially, is how closely do two of these patterns align or clash. So then Pythagoras took this idea, and he was the first to expand it to what is now a Coldplay album, Music of the Spheres.
Okay.
Which is so unfortunate, because now when you look it up, you have to go, wait, Music of the Spheres, philosophy. Music of the Spheres, Pythagoras. But he, his was the idea that the way that the heavenly bodies move through the cosmos, the way that the planets go around the star, but they were, you know, not at that level yet, were at, you know, predetermined and consistent speeds. At this point, they knew that. They could see the cycles of the stars and the way things move in the sky. Yeah. He decided, wait a minute, that probably makes music.
Ooh.
That's probably making some divine harmony, or singing some celestial song.
So let me see if I understand. So the movement of like Mercury, say, through the sky at night, I understand that it transits, right? I understand astrology well enough to know that it like, and then it does its retrograde for a bit, and then it keeps going. And so Pythagoras mapped that transit to like a curve, I guess, and called that a note, or derived a note from it?
More or less, yeah. He looked at, you know, let's say let's say Mercury is moving around the sun at such and such a pace, Jupiter is maybe moving a perfect octave away from that. But I mean, we have to go into other philosophers to kind of get more information, because obviously now we know that things don't move in a perfect circle. The planets go in, you know, an ellipse, in an oval pattern.
Right.
And it was Kepler who figured out that the different speeds of one planet, when it's closer to the sun versus when it's at the more extreme end of the oval, those form these perfect ratios. Mars, for instance, moves at two different speeds at different points in its orbit. One of those two speeds have a ratio of 4 to 5, which is that perfect fifth.
Ooh, the hell?
So it's actually a lot more complicated than Pythagoras or anyone even thought, because then, Kepler spent many years trying to map this into music, trying to map these into notes and actually write it out, and failed.
And
he was the first one to ultimately say that we probably would have to be living on the sun to hear what this is supposed to sound like.
Oh. Yeah. And we're getting there. That's what we're matriculating towards, right? As we enter each nirvana, each planet's nirvana, we're getting closer and closer to understanding the music of the spheres from the perspective it's meant to be heard.
Exactly.
Wow.
I love that you just brought all of that full circle. Because Kepler and Pythagoras both also, like the Venusians, supposedly, believed that the whole universe was populated. That every planet, be it by, you know, spirits or by beings that are able to manifest bodies, were inhabited. And who was it? On one of the episodes of the DTFH that was made into the Midnight Gospel.
Mm.
Crap, I just remember them by their characters. Not by the names of the actual people.
Name the character. I might.
Fishhead?
The fish head is, it's Joey Diaz. You're taking food out of my guppy's mouth, I think.
Oh, no. Pirates.
Yeah, that's
such an absurd show.
I think that episode is Damien Eccles.
That might sound right. The concept that they were talking about was this idea of building a solar body. And that was the exact word they used, was solar.
Oh, solar consciousness. I've heard of this.
Yeah. What they said on the episode was that the first time you experience enlightenment, where you're able to hold all of the universe in your consciousness with you, you get your first spark of solar consciousness. Yes. And then every time you go back to that level, you're slowly building, you know, cell by cell, this body for yourself to live in.
Hmm.
And the fact that it's the exact word, building your solar body.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you mess around with this, like, this idea that, like, everything kind of points to some primeval religion that they all, it's perennial philosophy in the words of Aldous Huxley?
Hmm. I guess I'm not super familiar with that concept. I've not really, I'm sure I maybe have heard of it in other metaphors, but as you say, every time we try to talk about this, we're throwing another layer of obscurity over it.
Yeah. It's the way that if you look at like three grandchildren and they all have blue eyes, you have a pretty good assurance that one of the grandparents had blue eyes, right? Because that's the way things get passed down. And so, like, the fact that so many of the world's religions have these, like, qualities or stories or even just, like, turns of phrase, like solar consciousness in common, it suggests that there's an ancestor to all of them that is maybe, like, the true religion that we could potentially reconstruct and build our solar bodies and you know, move on to the next plane, whatever that might be.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, someone had to know what was going on. You know, at some point you would have been close enough to the beginning that you could just remember. And, yeah. And this, the idea that it has just been diffused and dissolved and broken up and wherever there's been a crack in the story, you know, there's then room for like moss to grow on the side of it. Yeah. And so you're holding this like moss covered piece of crystal saying this whole thing is religion. And it's like, no, it's actually just the bit at the center that's been traveling through the cosmos for thousands of, you know, however long to get to this point.
Mm-hmm. Unfathomably long.
So I definitely do gel with that concept. That's another thing. And unfortunately, Christianity is, it gets so much right, but it gets so much wrong.
Yeah.
It obviously, you know, that's where we get this kind of young Earth concept.
Right.
That, you know, the planet might be only 4,000, 5,000 years old. And just... But they claim to be, obviously, this, the primordial religion. You know, they claim that essentially we modern Christians are direct ideological descendants from Adam, who walked and talked with God and received the information directly. You know, they think that there has been this, or at least they attempt to claim that there has been this unbroken line from source to the modern Christian.
I that's so far outside of my experience that I've never actually thought about that.
Yeah, it obviously, if you just go around telling everybody that, you're gonna get a lot of wrong ideas that are being fed a lot of ego. But yeah, the concept, and this is why I kind of break it down back to Abrahamic monotheism, is that it's not a story about a charismatic individual. It's exploring this concept of a universal shared originality.
Originality as in origin.
Yeah, God, source.
Source. Yeah.
Which then, the, you know, you said you're much more familiar with Eastern philosophy. That is something that really coincides with the Book of the Way and what Lao Tzu was saying in like 400 BC. So also well before Christ came to say anything. And the Book of the Way is this book of poetry, at first and foremost, that talks about, he says, for lack of a better name, I call it the Tao. And there we get Taoism and everything else that has come from that. But this unseeable, untouchable, unknowable, unchangeable, raw material that the universe was made out of, that once it all gets broken back down to its, you know, composite elements, and those get broken down to their smallest point, that it's all just the same at this baseline. And he calls that substance, maybe for lack of a better word, the Tao.
We're back. I figured out what the dogs are barking about. It's my wife just left. So I want to like sort of gently nudge us towards some closing thoughts, because I do need to get my daughter from school.
Certainly.
But you know what? Like we've been talking about online already, there's so much fuel for like 100 more episodes, and I definitely want to explore fucking Taoism. Like there's so much there. I think it's for another podcast, and we will get to it. But maybe to close this one out, we can return to the Eight of Swords. This lady who's, you know, kind of like trapped in her own head and not seeing things clearly, as we've discussed. Yeah. And is feeling like maybe some anxiety or uncertainty. Shit sounds like me right now. I don't know. What does it bring up anything for you to share with us as some final thoughts?
No, definitely. Just how that kind of still relates to just where I'm at in this process as an artist. You know, I started out with nothing in mind. Truly, I said I'm going to have a lot of free time on my hands, and I need to do something creatively or I'm going to go insane. And so that is just how everything started, to now here within the last 4 months, you know, I've started appearing in museums, in online galleries. You know, people are talking about buying my artwork. And you know, I'm finding my way, obviously, onto podcasts like this being my first ever podcast appearance in my life. So yes. This
thank you for choosing me.
The universe chose for us to have this episode together. It was all so so aligned that this had to happen. And so just definitely feeling very, very lost and confused and disoriented. And, you know, like there are, here's another point that's not clarified. Do the swords actually exist? Or is that just how she perceives the environment around her? Whereas if she took the blindfold and the restraints off, the swords would disappear.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like they, swords in the tarot represent like the intellect and thinking and thoughts. And so what we could be seeing is her internal landscape. She's projecting these swords around her because her vision is obscured.
And as I recall, the swords are pointed downward and their tip is lost in the ground. So it's not even a productive sword necessarily. So possibly these are, you know, these swords represent the fears and the limitations that I might be manifesting in my own mind to hold me back.
Yeah. We're all doing it, you know? I think I'm gonna take that to chew on. The swords in my own life seem to really be piling up over the last couple months.
Mm.
And I don't think that I'm going to be able to see this card without relating it back to that idea of like, well, maybe, you know, maybe these thoughts are just my own projections and I don't need to take them so seriously and feel so trapped by them.
Yeah, because as we pointed out earlier, they don't actually entrap her. She's not actually in a cage. That's it just right. Seems that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I like this, though. I like this. It's like, it's one level above even what people typically say. It seems that, like, it's, people will, I've never heard anyone question the existence of the swords, but it, I think it works perfectly with the themes of the tarot.
That's one of those things that honestly just struck me in the moment. And
yeah.
I think that happens a lot, and it makes me, this is one of the swords in my life. It makes me wonder, you know, am I just full of crap? Am I just making this stuff up?
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, you are not full of crap. You are full of art. It is no surprise to me that people are expressing interest in buying your stuff or that it's getting hung up in museums. You shared your website on the Creek Mason Discord, and there's a lot of beauty there. Do you want to share it with the podcast audience as well?
Oh, yes, of course. Thank you so much for saying all of those kind words. Yeah, it's up on weirdlifestudios.com. And that's going to have all of my artwork. I'm going to be posting a link to this podcast, my blog. I really want to make that just kind of a hub for all things Colin being put out into the world. I'll have guided meditations and who knows what in the future.
Oh, wow. That's exciting. I feel so grateful and so fortunate to have caught you right at the inflection point of your arc into notoriety and artistic success. I can't wait to do a meditation with you and all that other fun stuff. It's gonna be great.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Creek Masons. Thank you so much for becoming a node, and I'll catch you online, I suppose.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. And yeah, looking forward to continuing this conversation. Definitely. All right.
Yeah. Thank you.